breaking ball and a call. Strike three. Third strikeout for Zach.
He's going to just watch it go. A grand slam for Bryson Stott.
And there's a high fly ball. Deep right field. Harper watches it fly.
From WHYY and Billy Penn, it is hitting season, at least if you're not a member of the Phillies offense. Hey there, podcast pals. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight and Billy Penn. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Yes, the bats went quiet again in the series finale against the Cincinnati Reds as the Phillies have lost their second straight series to start the season. We'll break down these two games from Tuesday night and Wednesday night. Tuesday night was a whole lot of fun. We'll have some enjoyable moments talking about that game, but we're also going to talk about Wednesday night's loss to the Cincinnati Reds. I'll give you the breakdown of those two games. And the Phillies now at 2-4, losing their first two series of the season. Not great, but I've got a great author of a book coming out that you're definitely going to want to get a hold of. It's a new book about Pete Rose. Author Keith O'Brien joins me here in just a few minutes on Hittin' Season to talk about his book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. It's a really, really good book. And so we're going to talk to him about what's in it from the former Philly and Cincinnati Red icon. And we'll also preview the upcoming series this weekend against the Washington Nationals. All that coming up here on this edition of Hittin' Season. Let's get into, well, some unpleasantness, I guess we'll say, from the Wednesday night 4-1 loss at the hands of the Cincinnati Reds, a team that I don't think is all that good. A lot of people's pick before the start of the season to be a surprise contender in the National League Central, but you know, that's like saying this place serves the best liver and onions in town. I mean, it's what nobody wants that. And the Cincinnati Reds, even if they win the National League Central, still might not be all that good. And you watch you look at the Reds, and the Phillies are a better team than this team. You can see it looking at the roster, looking at the pitching staffs, looking at the lineups. And yet the Reds take 2 of 3 from the Phils here in some really brutal weather these last two games. I mean, human beings should not be playing baseball in the type of weather these teams have played the last couple of nights, but play these games they did. The game here on Wednesday night was delayed, I think, a little over 4 hours. First pitch was a little after 8 o'clock Eastern time. It was slated to start at 4:05. It was actually supposed to start at 1:05, but the day before, the teams decided to push the game back a few hours to give themselves a little bit of space from the weather system that's been moving through the Northeast and essentially blanketing all of us who live in the Northeast with nothing but cold rain for the last 48 to 65 hours, or however long it's been. But neither team wanted to give up their off day on Thursday, and so they waited it out. They got started at a little after 8 o'clock, and the Phillies lose 4-1 to the Reds. So one night after the bats woke up and gave us all a good time, they went back to sleep in this one. Now, the Phillies' 2-4 start to the season, let's be fair to the hometown nine, a game better than last year's 1-5 start. So we're getting there, you know, making some headway, making improvements here. The offense, as cold as the early spring night on which they tried to play, outside of a Kyle Schwarber solo home run that nearly decapitated a human being in right field, the Phillies only had one real good scoring opportunity in this game when they loaded the bases with two outs in the sixth inning, but they were not able to convert. Brandon Marsh popped out to third as the team was down 3-1, and that was really their last best shot. Now, in some good news, it should be noted that Zach Wheeler, in his second start of the season, was outstanding once again. One earned run, 3 unearned runs in this game in 6 innings of work with 10 strikeouts and just 1 walk. He's now 0-1 on the season with a 0.75 ERA. So the good news is that Zach Wheeler is out here straight dealing. The bad news is it's the second great Zach Wheeler start that the Phillies have absolutely wasted. Remember, they wasted his 2-0 lead that he gave them on opening day. As a team, the Phillies hitters struck out 10 times and walked only 4 times, continuing this trend with this team of lots of strikeouts with few walks. The strikeout-to-walk ratio, not good for the Phils. Johan Rojas continues to be lost at the plate. You really have to wonder if it's doing him more harm than good by staying up here right now. And if the Phillies haven't gotten to that point yet, you wonder at what point does the pressure that the fan base is going to put on him get to a point where it's more harmful? I think Rob Thompson mentioned before the start of the season that, you know, unless he was really feeling underwater, unless he was feeling kind of overwhelmed with the pressures of having to perform, that he would stay in the big leagues. And maybe Rojas, it just is a water rolling off a duck's back. The problem is that the rest of the guys in the lineup aren't hitting well enough to allow Rojas's offensive struggles to hide in the background. You've got Trey Turner, who's gotten off to a slow start. Again, understanding we're just talking about six games here. And with all of these things that I'm talking about, understand that we have to do podcasts every couple of days to talk about this baseball team, and we have to address what we're seeing on the field. With every bit of criticism, with all the different things we're pointing out here, if anyone is listening that is annoyed by that and is shouting into their iPhones or into the Apple CarPlays in their cars, it's still early, it's just six games, please understand that all of the things that are being said here are said with that understanding, that I understand that it is early in the season. There are a lot of different ways this thing can go. Everybody has a bad week during the course of a season, except if it was during the steroid era, right? Everybody has a bad week. Everybody slumps. And for some of these guys, the slumps come early in the season. Kyle Schwarber's gotten off to a good start. Normally, he really struggles in April and May, so that's a good thing. Bryce Harper had the great game on Tuesday that we're going to talk about in just a second, but he has largely struggled outside of that game. But, you know, he's going to have a game like he had on Tuesday night. You can kind of live with a night like he had on Wednesday. But for guys like Trey Turner and Nick Castellanos and Bryson Stott and Alec Bohm, these guys have yet to get it going. And they will at some point, I'm sure, but it is frustrating. And they are not able to hide the deficiencies of Johan Rojas hitting in the number nine hole right now. So it's not really fair to Rojas, but I don't feel like he is providing enough on the defensive side of things to make up for his offensive shortcomings. And he got picked off on Tuesday night. Like, he just, on one of the few times he got on base, he can't do that. The hit that he had the Phillies' first hit of the game here on Wednesday night. It was an infield single. Like, he's not a productive offensive major league player, not even a serviceable offensive major league player right now. So you just have to wonder how long he's going to be able to stay in the big leagues. It's just 1 week. Just 1 week. Again, nobody's sending him down next week. I totally understand that. But that has been a tougher watch than I was anticipating. And it wasn't just offensively on Wednesday night when the Phillies weren't able to get anything going and was the main reason why they lost. They made a number of sloppy plays in the field. The defense has been abysmal here to start the season. Now, understanding, of course, that the weather is awful. They've been playing in 50-degree weather with rain and wet and slippery, slick conditions. So I am giving a modicum of grace to this team for the defensive miscues here, especially over the last 2 days. But you had Bryson Stott bobbling a grounder in the third inning that set the stage for two unearned runs to score. Had Stott not made that error, the Reds would not have had the opportunity to score those two runs with two outs in the inning. So those two runs were unearned. Nick Castellanos misjudged a fly ball in right field that was ruled a double. That set up the Reds' third run after an RBI double was hit right after that. And Castellanos has not looked good in right field defensively. Came out after the game. He has told Rob Thompson that the new disgusting electronic digital ad board out in right field, where the out-of-town scoreboard, the old-fashioned out-of-town scoreboard used to be, is messing with him. Now, I don't know how that's possible, but he said it feels like it's right on top of him, apparently, and so he's unsure how close he's getting to the wall, maybe because the colors are so bright and vibrant that it feels like the wall is closer. But I heard Ricky Bitalico talking about this on the Phillies postgame show. Outfielders, before every game, count the steps. They know from wherever it is that they're stationed in the field, they know how many steps it's going to take for them to get to the warning track and to the wall. For a guy who's played in this right field, again, understanding with the out-of-town scoreboard, there are probably far less flashing lights and distractions behind him. if it's a distraction because of the flashing lights and because of the bright colors, and it's causing his eyes to wander away from the ball or whatever it is, I guess I can understand that. But you got to adjust, buddy. I don't think the ad board's going away. I don't think we're going to see less advertisements because it's hindering you in the outfield. I would be very surprised if John Middleton gives the green light to no longer put the ads out there. And as Pitalico said, the fence is in the same place. It's located in the same place. It's still the same number of steps away from where you are normally positioned. So this really shouldn't be that big of a problem. We'll see if it continues to be a problem out in right field for Nick Castellanos, but he is voicing what he has said has been a problem for him here in the early going with the new ad board out along the right field wall, messing with him and his defense out there. Bryce Harper committed an error in this game. Now, it didn't come back to bite the Phillies, but we've also seen Trey Turner make a number of errors, two errors already this season after a season last year in which he was graded out as the second worst defensive shortstop in baseball. So Philly's got to tighten these things up. They just do not look like a team that came north from Clearwater ready to start the season. They just don't look ready. The starting rotation outside of Aaron Nola's start in the second game of the season has looked ready. And the bullpen, after a shaky beginning, has done a decent job these last few days. But the offense specifically and the defense does not look ready. The position players just don't look like they got enough work in. They don't look like they did enough down in spring training, that they just kind of coasted through down in Clearwater. And I'm sure that's not the case, but they have come out playing sloppy, inefficient, and poor baseball to start the season. And the offense has not been able to get anything going except for what we saw on Tuesday night. And let's transition to a little bit of a happier topic, and that was the first Phillies Classic of 2024. We can call it the Bryce Harper ski mask game, maybe. I don't know if there's an official title for this one, but in this one, Bryce Harper hit his second career 3-home-run game, culminating with a grand slam that gave the Phillies an 8-1 lead in the seventh inning. They eventually won the game 9-4. We had some good vibes with the team on that Tuesday night and all throughout the day here on Wednesday before Wednesday night's game got started. Bryce Harper making a little history in this one with 3 home runs in a game, including one that was a grand slam. He became the third Philly to pull off that feat. Jason Wirth did it in his 3-home-run game in May of 2008, and Dick Allen did it in September of 1968. Bryce Harper is the 5th Philly to hit 3 homers in a game this century. Brad Miller, remember the Brad Miller game. Brad Miller did it in July of 2021. Of course, we mentioned Jason Wirth's. Ryan Howard did it in September of 2006. I think that was off of Mike Hudson, right? The big Mike Hudson game where he hit, I think it was 50, 51, and 52 that day. And Mike Lieberthal back on August 10th of 2002 are the others. Man, Harper has a knack for hitting home runs in brutal weather conditions, doesn't he? Remember the Bedlam at the Bank game? Game 5 of the National League Championship Series was played in conditions very much like we've seen here these last 2 days, except it was in October back in 2022. But I got it. When Bryce Harper is hitting home runs, there may be no more aesthetically pleasing thing in all of baseball to watch. I know he was... And that's funny. I don't know if you guys remember this, but Justin Clue, my co-host on the early of beginning of the week podcast, we were talking about the Phillies slumping offense, and we were talking about Bryce Harper, and he's the one who said, "Yeah, you don't really worry about Bryce Harper. You know, he's just kind of figured it out, and before you know it, he'll have a 3-home-run game to snap out of his funk." And darn if Justin didn't call it. Go back and listen to episode 797. About 20 minutes in, you'll hear exactly, you know, Justin say the very thing, talking about the predicting, not even really predict it, but just mention a 3-home-run game for Bryce Harper. Kind of an interesting thing. But watching that dude hit home runs when he's dialed in, and Justin was right, he can be in a slump and then all of a sudden snap right out of it. And remember in the spring when he had the back issues, we were talking a little bit about the fact that he didn't hit a single fly ball through the entire spring. Well, that hasn't been the problem here in the early going in 2024 here in the regular season. The 3-home-run game, just such a, he's just so much fun to watch with that violent swing ripping at the ball. And he doesn't hit the ball the farthest of anyone in the league. Like, he doesn't hit tape measure shots most of the time, although the Grand Slam went pretty far. But he typically doesn't hit them the hardest, and he typically doesn't hit them the farthest. But Bryce Harper, when he hits home runs, it is a sight to see. And the Phillies rode that six RBI game from Bryce Harper in the 9-4 win, three home runs, easy to do. Harper can do that. That's why you paid him the money. That's why he's the superstar. He can put a team on his back. But the Phillies have got to figure out a way to score runs on evenings when Bryce Harper does not hit three home runs. I don't think that's a sustainable formula for offense here with the 2024 Phillies. Five games, they haven't done much offensively. The one game they did something was Bryce Harper hitting three home runs. We also have to talk a little bit about the pitching performances on Tuesday night, because that was a big part of the story, and these guys were lifesavers. Spencer Turnbull, in his first start in a Phillies uniform, turned in an outstanding performance. Five innings, three hits, one run, none of them earned, no walks, and seven strikeouts. Paul Boyer tweeted, Spencer Turnbull became the first pitcher in Phillies history to get seven or more strikeouts, no walks, and no earned runs in his team debut. It's amazing that Halliday and Cliff Lee and some of these other guys never did anything like that. Watching him pitch, he has a nice little cut fastball that generated some swings and misses and some weak contact. You can see that if he leaves that pitch out over the plate, it's going to get hit pretty hard. So he's got to have good command and good location on that pitch, which he had on Tuesday night. He did feature a good changeup to lefties that dove down and out of the strike zone that generated some swings and misses for strikeouts. And he has a sweeper to right-handers that had the Reds chasing. So a great performance from Spencer Turnbull, exactly what the Phillies needed. And then the unsung hero of this game is former Philly Ricardo Pinto, becoming a legend here in his second go-around with the Phils. Kind of a cool story. The beat writers, I think it was Alex Coffey who wrote the story about the friendship between Ricardo Pinto and Ranger Suarez. Yes, it was her. Yeah, and she detailed the unbelievable trip that Ricardo Pinto took to get back to Philadelphia. Not over the course of years. I'm talking just about in one day. The beat reporters, Matt Gelb was the first, detailed Pinto's incredible day getting to the ballpark. He got the call around noon as he was with the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs in Rochester, New York, that he was being called up as the team DFA'd Connor Brogdon. The Iron Pigs were in Rochester, so they couldn't arrange a flight, so they drove to Philadelphia from Rochester, but got caught in traffic in Allentown, and they didn't arrive at the ballpark. It was like a six-hour drive. Didn't arrive at the ballpark until the fourth inning of the game. Tim Kelly tweeted this note from Rob Thompson's pregame media session on Wednesday that Pinto got dropped off in the center field gates, had to meet Phillies director of team travel, Jameson Hall, to sign his contract, and then walked through the stadium with the fans, as the fans were coming in. He then went and played catch and went to the bullpen. He said he met Rob Thompson during the game, went out to the bullpen in the fourth inning, and was called on to pitch in the sixth inning. And mind you, as all this is happening, he's getting called in to pitch in some of the worst weather conditions allowable to play baseball in. Ricardo Pinto went 6 years and 194 days between appearances with the Phillies. According to the Elias Sports Bureau, it's the longest gap by a Phillies player since Marlon Byrd went 8 years and 322 days. That's spanning from 2005, when he made his big league debut with the Phils, until he returned as a free agent in 2014. The longest gap by a Phillies pitcher was the longest gap by a Phillies pitcher since Nelson Figueroa went 8 years, 187 days from 2001 to 2010. Pinto, by throwing the final four innings, he did give up three runs, two of them in the ninth inning after the Phillies had worked up a 9-2 lead, but my man was just pumping strikes. He's just trying to get that game to the end point and save the bullpen, and he did it. It was a heroic performance from a guy who spent half the day in the car, was called on to pitch in brutal weather conditions, and just went out there and gave them four innings that they desperately needed to reset the bullpen. The bullpen's been overused here in the early going as starters have pitched well, but not terribly deep into games to start things off. And the bullpen has had its ups and downs, so that they haven't been able to use these guys quite as efficiently as they would have liked. And they don't really have a long man. Until now, Ricardo Pinto will likely be that long man moving forward, but they want to use some of these guys in multi-inning roles, and they just haven't been able to do that. So a lot of these guys are kind of getting burned out a little bit. But with the off day coming up on Thursday, the Phillies were able to get everybody some rest on Tuesday night and should have everybody ready to start the series in Washington this weekend, which we'll talk about in just a second. But a disappointing finish to the homestand. I think there was some hope that maybe the Phillies would bounce back after the game on Tuesday night and finish off a Reds team that's not as good as they are. But Cincinnati came out and pitched pretty well. The Phillies were sloppy, and the offense once again reverted to what we saw through the first four games of the season. And the Phillies dropped their second straight series here to start the 2024 season, just like they did last year, although now just 2-4 instead of the 1-5 they started out the season last year.
Well, when you say the name Pete Rose and you're talking about the great baseball players of all time, he's clearly near the top of everyone's list. Not a perfect player, of course, but his longevity and his ability to get base hits unparalleled in baseball history. But of course, it's the guy off the field that a lot of people viscerally respond to, including here in Philadelphia, where he is seen by many as a savior. And there's a fascinating new biography out about Pete Rose that I wanted to talk about and talk to the author about. Keith O'Brien is the author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Keith, thanks for joining me. How are you?
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's Pete Rose is a fascinating character, and it just seems like you could do biographies on Pete Rose repeatedly and it would still be entertaining because he is one of baseball's most fascinating players, characters of all time. What will we learn in this biography that maybe we haven't heard before or seen someplace else? What makes this a biography that might be a little bit different from some of the other biographies we've seen about Pete Rose?
Well, I think there are several reasons why it's different. For starters, I got unprecedented access to Pete Rose and to men in his inner circle. I was able to conduct 27 hours of interviews with Pete Rose until he stopped calling me back, John. He doesn't call me back anymore. I was able to interview three different men who placed his bets on baseball. I conducted interviews with others in this book who have never spoken before. And I also utilized for my research thousands of pages of court documents, federal court documents that had never, you know, been drawn on before. And these documents, you know, paint a world that Pete Rose was living in that was decidedly different than the one that we saw, you know, on TV. And so, you know, for all those reasons, I think this is different. And there are revelations in the book that, you know, that I do think further the story. And in part because, John, I obviously this is a baseball story and there's a lot of baseball in the book. But I never saw it as a baseball story. I saw it as a human story, the story of a man, you know, from a working class neighborhood in Cincinnati, a man of ordinary talents and athleticism, a man who, frankly, has no reason to ever be great at baseball, but does, climbs his way to the mountaintop through hard work and also, by the way, a lot of lucky breaks, and then loses it all, mostly because of his own decisions, choices, and addictions. I think that's just a compelling story.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the off-field stuff and downfall. First, about as far as his play on the field, for people of generations, these last few generations, who they never got to see Pete Rose play. I mean, for Philadelphians, he's a part of our lore, obviously, coming to the team in 1979. They fell short in 79, but then in 1980 is a linchpin, a huge reason why the Phillies broke that 96-year curse and won their first World Series. Surprisingly, did it at 39 years old. I think in Philadelphia, Philadelphia of Pete Rose being much younger than that, simply because he continued to play for many years after that. But 39 when he during that World Series season. And, you know, it's for Philadelphia fans, I think, in their mid-40s and on up, I think he's still largely seen as a positive figure in the city of Philadelphia. I think fans maybe of a younger generation fixate a lot more, justifiably so, on some of the off-field stuff. But what made him so great on the field? Like, he had the nickname Charlie Hustle. Was that all legend? Like, what is it that made him, what is it that allowed him to kind of move past his maybe physical limitations or lack of athleticism or whatever it might be to become baseball's all-time hits leader?
The hard work is real. The grit is real. You know, and the hustle is real too. You know, we would scarcely know what to do with someone like Pete Rose if he was playing today. They scarcely knew what to do with him back then. You know, this was at a time when every player, even the star players, were playing for the next year's contract. They were playing for the next year's salary. Nobody had multi-year deals. Nobody had guaranteed money. And even in that time, John, Pete Rose stood out to the point that it upset other players. They thought the way he played, how hard he played, was showing them up. So the hustle, the grit, the hard work, it's all real. You know, it's mythologized too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not until 1979, his first year with the Phillies, that women are allowed to be in major league locker rooms, female reporters. And by the way, they only get access to the Phillies locker room and every other locker room that spring because of lawsuits that have been filed across the country. And so in the first 16 years of Pete's career, the press corps is all male. It's almost entirely all white. And I do think that's notable, because, you know, I think the press saw in Rose something that they liked about themselves. This was sort of the classic underdog story, and Pete personified that.
Let's talk also now about some of the seedier stuff involving Pete Rose, because I think most people, when they hear the name Pete Rose now, especially nationally, they think about the scandals, right? They think about the gambling. They think about his relationship with underage women. They think about all these different things about him. And this was not something that just popped up late in his career, right? From the start of his career, Pete Rose was dealing with a lot of these kinds of personal issues, whether it be issues with women or whether it be the gambling. I mean, do you get a sense in going through this? Which of these items do you think is more harmful to Rose's legacy? It would have to be the gambling, right?
Well, the gambling is obviously what he was banished for, and what he has paid the price for. You know, I will say, obviously, you know, I reject, you know, the way that Pete Rose has engaged with women, you know, especially during the 1970s. I don't defend that. The book doesn't either. What I think is stunning is that by the late 1970s, by the time he comes to Philadelphia, these things we're talking about, his relationships with women, and there were many, and his gambling are well known. I mean, they're open secrets in the clubhouse. You know, based on my reporting, you know, by 1978, baseball itself, Major League Baseball, is concerned enough about Pete Rose's gambling that there is some kind of meeting in Cincinnati to discuss it. And at this meeting, the topic is are his debts, debts to bookies. It's also clear based on my reporting that the president of the Cincinnati Reds by 1978, Dick Wagner, was quite concerned about Rose's off-field behavior, especially with bookies. And, you know, he did very little to hide his many affairs in the 1970s. You know, I interviewed a woman in the book who's never spoken before. Her name is Terry Rubio. She was a longtime mistress of Pete Rose's in the 1970s. And Terry told me that when she was with Pete during the 1976 and 1977 seasons, she booked her travel directly with the Reds' traveling secretary.
So not a secret in any way, shape, or form, obviously, if she's doing that. Keith, last question for you here on this. In terms of being embraced by baseball again someday, he's running out of time, obviously, for that to happen while he's still alive. And you say something in the book, which I think is interesting. And I guess my question is, do you think he would be in the Hall of Fame if he had simply said the words, "I'm sorry, I bet on baseball"?
If he had said those words with earnestness and honesty and humility, and if he had said them at any point early in the investigation in 1989, my reporting shows that the story is entirely different. One thing we've forgotten, John, is that this was bad for baseball in 1989. In the same way, by the way, that the current, you know, gambling scandal involving Shohei Ohtani's interpreter and perhaps Shohei himself and an alleged illegal bookie in Southern California is really bad for baseball right now. So, you know, this scandal is bad for baseball in 89. The first meeting that was held about it was a secret meeting. Pete Rose is invited to New York to meet with outgoing commissioner Peter Ueberroth, incoming commissioner Bart Giamatti, and Bart Giamatti's handpicked deputy, Faye Vincent. And at this meeting, they ask him point blank, are you betting on baseball? That's what we've heard. And if Pete is honest that day, or if he's honest at any other point that spring, when it becomes glaringly obvious that it wasn't just a rumor anymore, baseball had now evidence that he was betting on baseball. I believe that the punishment would have been different. I'm not suggesting that he still would not have been punished. He would have been. But baseball would have done everything it could to salvage Pete Rose. And I do believe in particular that Bart Giamatti, the commissioner of baseball, would have done so. Giamatti was an incredibly intelligent man. He was a man of high ideals. Pete Rose had obviously violated those ideals. But Bart Giamatti was also a man of empathy. And if Bart had lived, or Pete had been honest, all of this is different. We might not even be talking about it now.
What might have been, if Pete, and people have to remember too, when this happened, the height of Pete Rose's stature in the game and as a national star was really something that can't be understated. So what it was an incredible scandal of the 1980s, and of course the Pete Rose story continues, it evolves, and like Keith said, there's lots of really good nuggets in this book that you're not going to see anyplace else. So make sure that you check out Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Keith, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, John.
All right. Well, let's finishing off the podcast. Let's look ahead to this weekend's matchup against the Washington Nationals. The Phillies head to the nation's capital in peak cherry blossom blooming. Actually, it's not peak. They're starting to turn just a little bit. You're about a week late if you're coming down to Washington, D.C. To watch some Phillies and you want to go catch some cherry blossoms. But it's still beautiful along the tidal basin. So I've always been kind of like, what's the big deal about the cherry blossoms? Because I live in Northern Virginia and there are cherry blossoms throughout our neighborhood and, you know, throughout the area. I know they're not popular everywhere, but I never really figured like why it's such a big deal. But then as I was driving down the 14th Street Bridge, which takes you from downtown, from the National Mall back into Northern Virginia, Alexandria, Arlington and the like, you get it when they're in full bloom and they are completely ringing the tidal basin. It is pretty amazing to look at. It really is. So if you are coming down to the nation's capital, check it out. It is kind of it's a neat thing to go do. And I would encourage you to do it this time around because they have to make repairs to the tidal basin over the next couple of years. And they're going to be ripping out almost all of the trees that are around the tidal basin. Now, they're planning to replant them temporarily and reinstall them once the work is done, because the tidal basin, the wall is breaking down. They got to fix it. But it's going to be sad for all those trees to move out of there. So you won't have that portion of the Cherry Blossom Festival. You won't have that part of Washington, D.C. to go take a look at. So this is the year to do it if you're coming down to Washington, D.C. to watch the Phillies this weekend. Anyway, the Phillies begin a three-game series with the lowly Nationals. The Nationals have not announced their pitching rotation as of yet for this weekend. The Phillies will march Aaron Nola, Ranger Suarez, and Christopher Sanchez to the mound for these three games against the Nationals. The Nationals actually enter play on Thursday, a half a game up on the Phillies in the National League East with a 2-3 record. But I'll tell you, I've watched a couple of Nats games so far this season. They stink. The Phillies really need to take advantage. It's early in the season. The Phillies don't need to do anything just yet. But as a fan, it would be really good for the Phillies to take advantage of the soft underbelly that is their schedule now coming up here over the next few weeks. They have a three-game series against the Washington Nationals, and then the Phillies will travel to St. Louis for a three-game series with the Cardinals, and then the Phillies will come back to Citizens Bank Park, and they will host the Pirates for a four-game series before then hosting the Colorado Rockies for a three-game series after that. And then the Phillies host the Chicago White Sox for a three-game series before going to Cincinnati and taking on the Reds. I mean, this is a prime spot for the Phillies to play well. And for everybody who says that it's early, the schedule is going to be much more difficult later in the season. These next 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, are filled with cupcakes. There is no reason why the Phillies shouldn't come out of this 5 or 6 games over 500. We should be expecting that from this team. You heard me run those teams down. This is a collection. Now, I picked the Cardinals to win the Central, but I don't think the Cardinals are a terribly good team. The Phillies are a better team than all of the teams they're playing, and some of these teams are just flat out lousy. I mean, the Rockies? Are you kidding me? The White Sox? The Nationals? Guys, this is, you're going to get the Reds again. The Reds are okay, but I mean, again, the Reds and Cardinals, they're not juggernauts. The Phillies, absolutely, we should be expecting them to go, I think they have to go 5 or 6 games over 500. Like unless you're going to play over 500 against all the really good teams that you're going to play in August and September, they could certainly do that. But I don't want to put too much emphasis here on the early part of the schedule, especially in the wild card era. You can get off to a slow start in April and May and still be just fine. But the schedule is set up for them to bank wins early. That is what the schedule makers have done. They have set things up for the Phillies to get off to a fast start. But they got to find their bats. They got to start playing clean baseball in the field. They got to hope the starting rotation continues to pitch well. They got to hope that Aaron Nola's first start of the season was a blip on the radar. The other guys have been really good so far. It looks like the bullpen is starting to find its sea legs now. But the offense has got to get the bats going, especially against this substandard pitching that they are about to see over the next 3 weeks. There are no excuses for the Phillies offense to not perform better over these next few weeks. And it is early in the season. The season does not rest on these next 3 weeks, but this is an opportunity for this team to get above 500, get themselves in a good position, and make a little hay on some inferior opponents here in the early going. I don't think it's too much to expect this team to finish 5 or 6 games over 500 after the stretch of games that I just ran down for you. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Keith O'Brien once again for joining me on the podcast. And just very quickly about the book, Charlie Hustle, Ellen Adair, our good friend of the podcast, provides the voice for the audio version of the book. So if you're an audiobook person, you like to listen on Audible or Google or wherever else you can listen to books online and your ears on listen to an audio version of it, Ellen Adair is the narrator for it. So give our good friend of the podcast, Ellen, a little bit of your time as she reads to you Keith O'Brien's book, Charlie Hustle. It is a good book. You guys will really enjoy it. And we'll have Ellen on the show coming up in the next couple of weeks as her schedule eases a little bit, so we can talk to her about that and get her thoughts on the Phillies. But we're also going to continue to have some great guests on the podcast over these next few weeks and months. You just don't know who it's going to be from week to week. Isn't that fun? Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.